It's Sunday, November 4th, 2012, and you're listening to episode 282 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 5 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
All right, and that's it. We actually have two people on the show today, sort of. We have two people and three guests. Let me go ahead and introduce our guests just by name. Then we're going to go back and hit their credentials. And in the middle of that, I'll explain why the heck they're on the show. So joining Wayne and I today, first we have Cape.
Hi.
We also have another gentleman by the name of Dan, but I'm going to be calling him Sergeant Dan.
Hello.
And I call him Sergeant Dan. He's actually ex-USMC, but I asked Dan at the last year of the con because he said, I'm an ex-sergeant. And I said, Sergeant, when does a Marine stop being a Marine?
Never.
Never. And so, therefore, you are Sergeant Dan to me. And then also joining us is Ryan.
Hello.
Okay, so who are these three people and why the heck are they on the show? Some of them you might recognize from the forum. Sergeant Dan and Ryan in particular are both pretty active on the forum. Sergeant Dan, I think, goes by Sergeant Dan USMC. And Ryan, I believe, goes by Mobius04.
Mm-hmm.
Cape, I don't know that you're active on our forums, but people might remember you from us mentioning articles by Cape Rust on gaming and the military. So what all three of these people have in common is they are all military veterans. And the reason that they are on the show today is we want to talk about gaming in the military. And my guess is, given the amount of material we come up with to discuss, this is probably going to be a two-parter. But that's what we're doing here. It's a roundtable on gaming in the military, and we're going to hit it from a couple angles. We've got all kinds of ideas that we're going to talk about. But before we get to that, I said I'd let them give their credentials. So just so you know who you guys are listening to, I'd love to hear who you guys were in the context of the military, where you served, what you've done, what ranks you've held, where you've been deployed. Cape, let's go ahead and start with you.
My name is Cape Rust. I got out as a staff sergeant in the United States Army. I served for 12 years, stationed in Korea, Germany, Bosnia, Serbia, Hungary, Croatia, Fort Campbell. I was a guard at the prison at the United States Disciplinary Barracks for a year and reclassified from military police to military intelligence. And my final assignment was Key West, Florida, working counter drug. Since then, as a contractor, I've trained African soldiers for peacekeeping missions in 11 different countries, trained Army staffs on counter-improvised explosive device tactics, as well as attacking the networks that build those IEDs, and now I build websites for the Army Training Network.
As a note to the listeners at home, we're recording this while Hurricane Sandy is in the middle of its furor. So right now, Dan and Ryan are both being affected by that. Being in the Midwest, the three of us are okay, but Dan and Ryan are both being affected by that. They may come and go a little bit. You may hear some kind of oddities in terms of who's responding to what, but we're going to hit them out of order since we just lost Dan to the hurricane. Ryan, why don't you go ahead and give us your story, and then we'll get back to Dan as soon as he reconnects.
I joined the Ohio National Guard my 18th birthday back in 2004. I went in as a 63 Bravo Grease Monkey. I was happy the first 18 months of my enlistment, and then I got reclassified to 94 Romeo Avionics. I was back in the unit for probably 20 minutes before someone said, "Hey, our sister unit's deploying to Iraq. Who wants to go?" Me and Burke raised our hands. Then I was reclassified to 25 Bravo. It's a network geek. From there, I went to Iraq. I was stationed at Balad, Iraq for a period of 9 months. I came back home, and since then, I transferred back to 94 Romeo. I'm currently a sergeant in the 638th.
You're currently a sergeant, so you are still active in the National Guard.
Yep, I'm still active. I've been in for about 7 years.
Before we get to Dan's credentials, Ryan, I did want to ask you a question real quick. You kept rattling off numbers and then letters there, you know, saying you were this or that Bravo. And just to clarify, are those MOS markings or what exactly do those indicate?
You'd be correct. They're MOS or military occupation specialty for those who don't know. It's always number, number, letter, and that determines what your job is, such as 94 Romeo is avionics. 25 Bravo is computer networking.
So that's what I was guessing, but I just wanted to be sure and also clarify for everyone at home that's like, what the hell is he talking about getting transferred from this to this to this and just rattling off all of that stuff. All right, so Dan, if you want to go ahead now and give us your pedigree, which is the word that came to mind because of the picture of the Rottweiler you use.
I'm ex-Sergeant Dan USMC on the Fear the Boot forums. I was in the Marine Corps 10 years, and 7 out of those 10 years, I was permanently stationed out of Cherry Point, North Carolina. I've been to 29 Palms, 2 9 consecutive years for training in my MOS, which was an aviation radio repairer, aviation radio technician. Also was on Okinawa for about a year. I've been to Korea, Norway, Turkey, Peru, Panama, and quite a few states. The only place I haven't been is the Northwest and above the Mason-Dixon line on the Northeast.
One of the questions that I want to ask you guys, and I'm going to try and phrase this carefully because I know there are certain just taboo questions one ought not ask, but I think there's one that I have to ask simply to help frame some of your experiences here for the sake of the podcast. Which of you, and I'll just put it this way, have seen action?
I primarily have been in a peacetime military. I was on drug interdiction in Peru where we had to set up a radar, and I have been shot at, and I have to agree with General George Washington that there's no greater thrill in life to be shot at with no effect. That's the extent of my quote-unquote combat. I spent 6 days at sea where I was cargo from Korea to Okinawa. So that was the extent of my sea duty as a Marine. So it was primarily a peacetime service for me.
I will not pretend to be anything more than I am. I never had to look at another man as he shot at me, though I was stationed in Balad, Mortaritaville. We got more incoming shelling in Balad than the entire theater of Iraq combined. The closest thing I've been to shot at directly was the day before I left when they were attacking and shooting up Balad for about 6 hours. And the guard tower next to mine, I was in Tango 34, the guard tower next to mine, Tango 33, was hit by an RPG about a month before I got stationed up in that tower. So every time I had to go up and man the tower, I got to see the broken bits of concrete and rebar as we drove past and go to mine. The closest brush I ever had to be a mortar round incoming about 20 feet away from my shop. The mortar round was a dud, obviously, but that wasn't the problem. It was the 500-gallon fuel tank that landed next to. That would have gone off. Now, there wouldn't be enough of me to scrape into a coffee cup, but I'm alive and well today.
There's hardly that much of you as there is. Cape, what about you?
A lot of my quote-unquote action was in a law enforcement capacity, whether it be riots in Korea, incidents on the road. Actually, ironically, some of the most threatening situations I was ever in was training peacekeepers in Africa because their standards of weapon safety and muzzle discipline are slightly modified from ours.
Peruvian conscripts are about the same.
We had an incident in Ethiopia where one of the soldiers decided to test fire his SVD or Dragunov sniper rifle, and he happened to be aiming it in the direction of the listening post observation post training area that I was in. And that distinctive crack and zing that you hear, it's one thing when you're expecting it, you know, when you're in the zone or when you're in an area where you're expecting it. But when you're training Africans in Ethiopia and that happens, let's just say you never trust a fart in Africa. And and the pucker factor was definitely there. But, you know, riots in Korea, stuff like that.
Okay. Dan, I want to take a moment now to just thank every one of you for your service. And for basically going over and doing what you did so we could stay at home and do what we do. And, you know, going through what you've all gone through so the rest of us don't have to. I know me personally, that means a lot to me.
And actually, Wayne, not only do I agree with you, but this actually ties right into a shout out. By coincidence, I actually just received this, but it also fits in pretty well with this episode. The message goes something like this. Hey, Dan, been listening to FDB since episode 20-ish. Hadn't really had reason to write in until today, listening to the kangaroo scrotum conversation. Thank you, Chris, for your contributions to the nation. I grew up in Montana, and I'm an avid tabletop gamer and hunter. I killed a mountain goat in 2004, had it taxidermied, and my dad had the scrotum tanned separately for some reason, and I used it for a dice bag on several occasions.
Yes!
Where's Chris when we don't need him? It's buried somewhere in my parents' house now. Wish I had it still. It's about the size of a tennis... I can't read some of this. It's a little graphic.
It just goes on and on for pages and pages.
All right, so let me skip forward.
This guy's got to be a paratrooper.
Let me skip forward to the relevant part here. Just got back from Afghanistan and finally have good enough internet to download your show again. If you could do a shout-out to all the 82nd Airborne paratroopers, that would be awesome. Have a good one, Sergeant Rose. So, Sergeant Rose, on behalf of Fear the Boot, I would absolutely be more than honored to give a shout-out to the 82nd Airborne. So, from us to you, here is a salute and a thanks for all that you guys do. You know, stay strong out there and know that there are those of us back home that still love and root for you guys very much.
And of course, because it is the 82nd, we have to shout out with a loud and thunderous Airborne!
Sergeant Rose, I also want to say if you were ever up in Raleigh, come up to Game Theory. I usually hang out there at the friendly local game store, and maybe we can hook up sometime.
Just think, they do what they do so we can talk about kangaroo scrotum.
Yeah.
And don't forget mountain goat scrotum.
Yeah, so Chris can do what he does. So anyway, the last thing real quick before we get down to the meat and potatoes of this show is just one last reminder that we do still have the postcards contest going on. Don't forget to check the show notes for that. We got some great prizes lined up. Some of them you pick. Some of them that are going to be coming from Jim Pinto, including the Ultimate Toolbox, which actually, after looking over John Love so much, he's now trying to get a copy of for himself, and the World's Largest Dungeon. So don't forget to get your stuff in for that. November 10th is the final deadline. We won't push it back again. We've got some great entries, and we're looking for some additional good ones. You can't win if you don't play, so there you go. All right, so let's get down to it. There are two angles that we want to talk about gaming in the military from. And the first one, which I think is probably going to be the shorter of the two topics, is not gaming as if you're in the military, not role-playing a soldier or trying to understand what military life is like. Because we've had a lot of people, both within my own gaming group and a lot of people that have contacted the show, saying that they struggle with the idea of a military campaign or playing a military character. And so we definitely want to talk about that at length. But before we get to that, I first want to talk about the other angle, which is literally role-playing in the military. Because, Cape, one of the things that you wrote about at length on Geek Life back when we were mentioning your Geek Life articles was the nature of role-playing within the military. And then going back some years, we also supported ZigguratCon, which was a gaming convention being held. I can't remember the exact city, but it was in Iraq.
Baghdad.
Was it in Baghdad? I thought it was not in Baghdad, but okay. Baghdad's a much easier name to remember than whatever city I was trying to come up with. So, but it was in Baghdad, Iraq. We supported that, and they ended up getting an enormous material support from all over the U.S. and the world in general, which was great. But I want to talk to you guys. Did you guys role play during, or in your case, Ryan, being still active, are you gaming while deployed or acting with the military? And what is that experience like? What are kind of the things that figure into that? What sorts of games do you play? Does being in harm's way affect the sorts of games you play? Excuse the pun, but shoot from the hip on this one. What was gaming like in the military?
Well, first of all, I think the biggest surprise I was in for is that I joined up when I was 18. I went to basic, and my ice-breaking question was to other kids in basic were, so, played D&D before? What was your character? And 9 out of 10 times, someone had a story to tell me. What it came to
I'm
later
so
on.
I'm so sorry. I am so sorry. I had no idea what you've given up for my freedom. You had to sit through that many character stories.
Look, when you have nothing else to do, when you have no DS, no internet, you have like one phone call every month, when you do that, you learn how to sit down, you talk to people, and that's what you do for entertainment and to pass the time. It's just been this transition over the years that gaming's been so prevalent in the military. When I deployed, everyone had an Xbox. You had everyone playing Call of Duty to anything in between. A hardcore Marine that you would never expect in a million years to be a gamer loved Warhammer 40K. He thought playing a space marine was the best thing ever.
You call anything a marine and yell hit the beach and they're all over it.
Look, when you give a marine a chain sword, a bolter rifle, and space armor, they're as happy as can be.
If we can kill people and break things, we're in heaven.
And you're doing it for the Emperor, so you automatically have everything in-game to justify your actions and say you're doing the right thing.
Core God and country, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I used to always think that people in the military wouldn't want to play military-type games. And then I've really looked at some of the characters that I've played in various RPGs. And I like being the hacker. I'm a computer guy by day. And my role-playing characters half the time are hackers because computers are what I know. And that makes me wonder if maybe that's the case here, too.
That can be a big part of it for a lot of people because that feels good. You like that sense of empowerment. You learn to get a lot out of it.
Well, let me ask you about that before we move on to kind of getting Cape and Dan's input. Not that this has to be so structured. I mean, you guys feel free to yell out anytime you want. But Ryan, one of the things I want to ask you, given that you mentioned people playing Call of Duty and such, it strikes me that when you're in a situation that's that intense and distressing, I mean, I would think my impulse would be to want to escape. And when I sit down to play a video game or play a role-playing game, I would be playing something that is as far away from my current situation as I possibly could. That if I'm going to role play, I'm going to play fantasy. I am not going to play some kind of a military setting. If I sit down to play a video game, good heavens, Call of Duty is going to be the last title on my mind. I mean, I'm going to be playing, you know, some freaking Walt Disney game or something like that. But I'm curious. Apparently, that's not the case. I mean, I don't even know what the question is there.
Well, the whole thing, first of all, in Call of Duty, that's fantasy.
Okay.
That military porn at its finest, in the sense that you don't always have UAVs on call. You don't have AC-130s. You don't get to fly in an AC-130.
The fights aren't fair.
Right. And then to take it just even at a very base level, you can get away with stuff in Call of Duty that you couldn't do in the real world because there's no rules of engagement. And you don't have to clean your weapons afterwards.
What people don't realize is that, allow me to phrase it like this. You have the stereotypical sports jock who never even looked at a computer in his life. You give him something involving hacking at a game, it's going to be a bit of a learning curve for him to learn how to get something positive out of that. War is the best drug of all time. It makes everything more intense and magnifies everything. So when you have a video game where you're able to have that outlet and you get that fix, only this time, all the negative parts are gone. You get to respawn, you don't need to clean your weapon. You want to have any outfit, you want to be well supplied, you want to have fair fights, it's there. And now you have so much more of a depth of experience you bring to the table to enhance that already powerful experience.
Let me ask you a really blunt question, which is, given the fact that one of the real problems within military life is post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. do you think that people playing those games can either A, trigger some of those attacks by taking them back to a negative place, or B, possibly keep them from ever moving their mind to another place and thus sort of obsessing and kind of helping lay a stronger foundation for later PTSD? Would they be better off escaping, or is this so far detached from reality that it's like it hardly even matters?
There is a depth of truth into that, though, but it depends on the individual. When you have guys coming back from overseas, they usually get pissed drunk for about 2 or 3 months or 20 years. But it depends on the person. If there's someone to actually want to address something and work through that, it actually gives a very healthy outlet to work through it. In order to get past a lot of the trauma, you have to retrain yourself. And that involves exposing yourself, going into a target-rich environment so it becomes more symptomatic to be addressed. If I'll be playing Call of Duty and initially I hear that rat-a-tat-tat or the pop-pop-pop of an M16, it can initially take you back. But you gotta know what's there. And if you know what's there and you're able to work on it, you can do something like Call of Duty and build out that practice, get your foot in the door initially, so that you can handle more and more intensive experiences, so that you don't flip out and it's not the war's over, Charlie Brown.
They actually are using not necessarily Call of Duty, but those type of situations in PTSD treatment facilities where they're trying to get soldiers to go back to that place, to deal with that place, and it's part of therapy regimens. And so if there's kind of a daily way that you can do that in a very safe environment, especially because even though we like to advertise that there's no stigma in going to get help,
yeah,
there still is. People still think they're going to take my gun away. They're going to take me away from my fellow soldiers, my fellow warriors, if I go and get help. Now, soldiers are becoming more and more open about it, but there's still a stigma there. And so when you have something like Call of Duty, yeah, it might not be government sanctioned and psychologically approved, but there is something kind of therapeutic about it. And again, there's, yeah, guys go down, but it's not the same as an IED strike where you're sitting there and you're smelling that visceral kind of a, it's kind of an experience light. But even in that therapy, they are doing things like introducing sounds and smells that will take people back, like Ryan said, to that place so that they can try to understand that, one, war is not their fault, and two, that they were in a situation that was almost surreal in the sense that they're fighting and it's a matter of I go home or the guy on the other end of that AK goes home. And I don't want to say kind of creating a rationalization process, but to be able to process that you're in a situation, you're not a murderer, you're a soldier. And so when you have something like Call of Duty, you can go out there and kind of get those little micro experiences.
I want to come back some more to talk about gaming in the military, but I guess let me add kind of some thoughts into this, because I know a little bit about PTSD. I myself have never been in the military. Given some of the minor physical and psychological quirks I have, I'm not sure they would take me for what, regardless. My point is, I've never been in the military, but I have suffered PTSD. And I don't want to go into a story of why, because it would be, one, a massive tangent, two, it's a story I'm not really sure I'm ready to talk about on the air just yet. But the point is, I have been in counseling at one point in my life for post-traumatic stress disorder that was triggered by a pretty unusual cause for PTSD. It was a rather unlikely series of events. But the point being, though, that during that time, I did get to learn quite a bit about the disorder, because when you have it, you kind of have to learn about it. The same way that the order I have talked about, panic disorder and anxiety disorder, which I have struggled with for over a decade now, I mean, I know quite a bit about. And one of the kind of prevailing theories on how PTSD works is that the mind is something like a conveyor belt. Something occurs, at which point you have a response. Eventually, that response gets processed through emotion, context. It's sort of digested by the brain and then pushed off the other end as a memory. And so if you ask me about dinner, well, there was a moment where I experienced dinner tonight. I had a reaction to dinner tonight, but it's now packaged off into a memory. And effectively, it's just any other piece of flotsam and jetsam in my life. But one of the prevailing theories about PTSD is that the conveyor belt breaks down, that something happens to where the stimulus occurs, but you never allow it to finish processing. In the case of a lot of trauma, you can't. If you are deployed into a combat zone, you can't stop and have a breakdown. You'll get killed. I mean, plain and simple. You have to keep functioning. You have to keep rolling Sisyphus rock again and again and again until you are done. And then by the time that you are done, you have spent so long with that memory stuck in the middle of that conveyor belt that you no longer are capable of processing it off to where it belongs, which is a rationalized memory. And a lot of PTSD therapy as a result requires trying to take people back to that experience, but doing so under a different context. Instead of doing so while they're, excuse the pun, under the gun, you do it while they are thinking and feeling thoughts that they couldn't think during the experience, which allows them to kind of unjam that conveyor belt and get those boxes moving again until eventually it reaches the place where it ought to go. In fact, there's a therapy called EMDR. I can't recall top of what EMDR stands for. I'll put a link to it in the show notes or something, where what they're trying to do now is while they have people recount the experiences, they try to stimulate alternately the left and right side of the brain to get you to engage parts of the brain that may not yet have been brought to bear on that experience. So I could certainly see how something like Call of Duty could play, I guess, an equally destructive or therapeutic role, depending on how the player observes the game.
Yeah, I would think a lot of movies and things can do it too. I mean, my mom won't be in the room with my dad if he's watching something about Vietnam. He gets interactive with it. I can't think of a good way to put it, but you can definitely tell it affects him. When he sees any particularly realistic movie set in that time period, he did a tour in Vietnam, he did a tour in Korea. So it's like he watches a lot of war movies, like World War II. None of that impacts him. But if it's Vietnam and if it's anything similar to his experiences, you can tell the change in him after all of these years still. I think back then, a lot of people that had post-traumatic stress disorder, it was never diagnosed. No. They didn't know about it to diagnose. They just came home and they did, like my dad would have nightmares. And even to this day, he still refuses to talk about what he saw.
Consider the stigma they had back in the day when World War II, Patton goes into a field hospital and grabs a guy, shakes him, and let's say shakes him and punches him, cussing him out because he sees him as a coward when the guy is really, one, he has shell shock, and then he has 102 fever and suffering from malaria. But because Patton saw him as just being, in his mind, a coward, he was called out and sent straight to the front line while he was still sick, while he was still injured. And that was the prevailing attitude back then post-World War II. Look at Audie Murphy. That was a PTSD case handled completely wrong because they didn't know anything about it back in the day.
Like in my dad's case, when he came back, it wasn't something he could talk about with anyone either. Because either you were there and you had a similar experience, or he just didn't bring it up because of the stigma around that particular war.
Well, this is one of those things where I think the military is kind of benefiting from changes in our society in general. The stigma surrounding mental disorders and psychological disorders, I wouldn't say it's gone, but it's not what it used to be. you can tell people that you suffer from depression or bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, or whatever. Yeah, people are still going to look at you a little odd, and it might change the way they interact with you. But on the whole, it is not going to make you the social pariah it would have made you to admit those kinds of things back in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, whatever.
My dad's uncles and my mom's uncles were in World War II. And my dad said he could remember one of his uncles getting really drunk and started telling of his experiences in World War II. And Uncle Jake got up into his face and said, "Knock it off. We don't talk about that. It's done and over." All military personnel are weapons. And part of the post-traumatic stress disorder is the weapon's jammed. The weapon has malfunctioned in some way, and you got to unload the weapon. If you don't, something bad is going to happen.
And one of the things that we're not taking into account, and again, this is a podcast about gaming, but we're in the psychological, is that we're not discussing the preconditioning of a soldier and how that affects how you deal with things. When you're in basic training and you're doing your bayonet training and you're saying, what makes the grass grow? Guts, guts, guts makes the grass grow. You're conditioned to kill people and break things. And so when you go through a preconditioning, like, you weren't necessarily trained to deal with whatever triggered it for you.
Right.
Whereas in the military, you are trained and you are preconditioned and you shoot at target silhouettes that look like Russians. You're conditioned to kill people and break things. And so when you encounter a situation where you can't effectively do that, the weapon is jammed, the weapon is broken, it's almost a double fall from grace because you're a warrior. You have that warrior ethos. You got that hua. You got that, I'm a Marine, I'm a soldier, I'm a sailor, I'm an airman, that pride. And then when you can't do what your primary focus is, which is to kill people and break things or facilitate other people killing and breaking things because your headspace and timing is off, then there's an additional impact on you.
As a quick aside here, I don't mind lingering on these topics for two reasons. One, they're important in and of themselves. But two, even within the context of a role-playing podcast, one of the things that we are trying to accomplish here is to help people understand what it means to role play a soldier, especially if you're going for a grittier, more realistic game, how to handle a military campaign or military characters. And I don't think we can talk about that while pretending that things like PTSD don't exist. Okay. And so I think that even the real world value aside, there is still a make-believe value to the discussion. Now, Kate, one thing I want to ask you about, going back to gaming in the military, is you wrote a series of articles about what it takes to game, especially when you are forward deployed, how you've got to keep it light, how you've got to improvise. I want you to talk about that. Those are some great articles. Why don't you talk about that?
You see pictures of guys playing Warhammer with MRE pieces, people throwing pieces of paper in a hat to replicate dice. You know, the Marine Corps is famous for improvise, adapt, and overcome. God bless you, Gunny Highway. And what's really nice now is with the digital PDF copies, you don't have to improvise as much. But like when I was deployed to Bosnia, Hungary, Serbia, if we wanted to role play, we had to kind of make up the rules because none of us had brought source books with us. So here we are going, is it Thaco? What is Thaco again? And sometimes it kind of ended up being that version of a bunch of adults playing that game that you played as a 12-year-old because you didn't understand the rules. It's almost like we'll kind of make up the rules as we go.
A Chad game.
Yeah.
Well, except here it's by necessity. I mean, if you're forward deployed in particular, I mean, taking with you stacks of source books is out of question.
Well, it was. But these days, you'd be surprised where you can stuff things in air loads. Or, for instance, when we went from Germany to Hungary, we had to rail load our Humvees. Well, had I known it at the time, I would have put source books under the seats in my Humvee. I would have found a better way to get those books. We didn't know how long we were going to be there.
You know, I was wondering about things like that, if you'd have paper, if you'd have pencil and things. But you mentioned like e-readers. You're right. I mean, this is the perfect use for them. You could have a whole bookshelf in one device, as well as character sheets and things like that. And even, you know, apps for dice rollers if you want dice.
Yeah, and this is something that we got advice on going back to ZiggurotCon. We, as Fear the Boot, took an approach to that. It seems like, and don't get me wrong, I'm not downing anybody's material support for that convention. Anyone who gave anything to that convention did a wonderful thing. But there's an approach we took that I didn't see anyone else taking. Not to say they didn't, I just didn't see it, which is what we sent were game kits. We did not send somebody a book. What we would do is once we got the cash donations in, which at the time, it was like $1,000 or $1,500 or something like that. And we were a smaller podcast, and so I mean, it was a phenomenal amount to raise for us. What we did was we would buy like a book, and this is not just any random book. This is the primary source book for this game, whatever that game might be. Now, let's presuppose they have nothing. So we are going to include some pencils, a pencil sharpener, a tube of dice, a folder. We even went to Kinko's. We pre-photocopied character sheets. We included blank notebook paper for taking notes or writing plot outlines. And all that was then put together typically into a little, like a canvas sort of like messenger bag. It was a little bit smaller than a messenger bag, but something like that. They put in these little canvas bags so that when it arrived, whoever got that bag had everything they needed to play that game, presupposing nothing. We did not assume they had anything but literacy. And that was part of our thinking was, you know, okay, once again, admitting I've never been forward deployed. I've never been in the military at all. But it's like, I can't presuppose that some guy who's out doing patrols in the Middle East is going to be sitting there at camp at night and have a pencil sharpener.
Right.
Or have a tube of dice.
Yeah. How bad would it be if all of that effort was put in? All of those products are there. They're looking at a character sheet and they're like, anyone got a pencil?
Yeah. Well, you know, but amazingly, you know, you mention all that. Somehow we still do PowerPoint presentations every freaking place we go. Have you seen the documentary Restrepo?
No, I have not.
Good things, bad things about it. But if you want to get an idea of being really forward deployed, because when that was filmed, Afghanistan was a mature theater. And here are these guys living in ammo crates, Vietnam style, out in this the Korngal Valley, which is just a horrible, horrible place as far as what goes on there, the terrain, everything you don't want, you've got, because even when you're on the high ground, there's higher ground that can shoot at you. But there was nothing good about that situation. But this documentary, if you do choose to watch it, and there's also a book, and there's actually an enhanced ebook that has film clips from Restrepo, the documentary. It's well worth watching because it really does give you an idea of those conditions.
When I was in the military, as far as my gaming experience, it was off and on. When I was out in 29 Palms for school, it was for a year, and it was basically a school setting. And I ended up playing Dungeons and Dragons with guys. Matter of fact, one of my best friends from the Marine Corps I met because I told him to get a haircut. I met him in the E-Club later, and he mentioned how he played Dungeons and Dragons. And he lives in the mountains of North Carolina, and we get up every once in a while. Towards the end of my career, computers were portable enough where I could sneak them into our repair shelter, and I could play World of Warcraft or SimCity or several other computer games. And when I was on Okinawa, we get basically drunk on hurricane parties and play Dungeons and Dragons just to pass the time.
You know, I can't imagine you drunk while role playing because you are by far the most intense role player I have ever been in a game with as it is. Maybe that was just because you were Yosemite Sam, but still, by far the most intense role player I've ever
seen. Well, I've seen him as Yosemite Sam. I think I've seen him in an Epoch Arisos game or two. I've seen him on the Star Trek bridges a few times. I don't think I've ever seen him drunk in any of those. Or if you do worry, you did a good job of hiding it.
My drinking that much, those days are long gone. Thank God, because it's too expensive.
Yeah, I've actually had the privilege of gaming with, I think, everyone here except for you, Cape. I have to say that Ryan was probably the most disturbed of my bards in my Bard's Bard game at
Afghan. That's good.
It was a close neck and neck between him and Adam from Kicked in the Dice Bags, but I definitely have to give it to Ryan for being the more disturbing of the two bards.
All right, so I want to move from gaming while in the military to gaming about the military, playing a military campaign or playing a soldier in a game. We have had quite a few people over the years, either in our gaming group or in our podcast audience, who have commented that they struggle with the idea of a military game. And it's been for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it might be, well, they don't exactly know what it's really like, or they don't feel like they can do it justice. And we'll try and hit on a bunch of these points. The two big ones that come up again and again, though, the two themes I hear over and over is either one, I don't like the idea of a command structure. They fear that the moment you say somebody's got this rank and you've got that rank, autonomy of action and person absolutely disappear. And so this is one of the big points I want to talk about. The second thing is they say, well, you go into boot camp, you get broken down, you get built back up. You get put out, you're under orders, and as a result, everyone, at least to them, seems fairly homogenous. They must all be the same. And I have... Well, and it's funny because in a few cases, when I'm talking to booters in particular, some of the people on the mics right now have been my examples. Like, wait a minute. You've met Ryan. You've met Sergeant Dan. You've met this guy. You've met this guy. They're all military vets. Are they like photocopies of each other to you? And they're like, well, no. I'm like, okay, so what's the issue? Now,
I'll throw this out since I was one of the people that struggled with this. One of the things I have a hard time when I'm creating a character that is based in a military, and I think that every issue I have will probably be worked out during the course of, you know, this episode.
Right.
I have a really hard time creating that character, envisioning that character as part of the military, partially because I don't know what the military is like.
Right.
I know that everyone that's gone through a branch of the military has had certain similar experiences when they go through basic training, things like that. I don't know what those experiences are because I've never gone through them. And I know that every military branch is different as well. And with modern games, it's a little bit easier for me because I can actually do a little research on the branches.
Right.
I can think about things like, okay, well, I know Sergeant Dan was a Marine. But I can't do that for future sci-fi games. It's like, well, we have the Vengeti Republic, for example.
Right.
I have no idea what their military culture is like to place my character within it.
Well, if this helps you, before we even get into this, and I think you gentlemen can agree with me, and I use that term liberally, even training guys in Africa, there's certain commonalities. Low pay, lack of sleep, bad food. That's three baseline characteristics in any military situation. Guys, are there any other common ones that you can think of? But I mean, that right there, no matter
what. I can only say that's three things I wouldn't have thought of when I was while trying to create a character until now.
Well, let me ask you guys another very simple question here. And then I have sort of a bridge topic that's going to lead us into this military.
I hope it's not a bridge too far.
No, it is not a bridge too far.
A lot of the commonalities, too, what you always look forward to is staying in touch with your friends and family at home, pay, and food, even if it is MREs. If you look at any military situation, that's what you look forward to, is your next meal. When mail call comes, when you finally get paid and you're actually able to go out and do something with that pay.
Let me make an observation that I'm going to have to context very carefully here, because it could come across extremely offensive if I don't. Would you guys agree? Would the three of you agree, based on what you just said, that some of the things you struggle with most in the military, an inflexibility of certain aspects of your life, things you have to do on a repetitive basis, exposure to traumatic events, and isolation from the people you love or the kinds of socialization you need. Would you agree those three things are true?
Minus the last one, and we can get into that later. But yeah, I think...
Here's an observation. And now I am not equating these two categories of people, okay? So we make that abundantly clear. But in terms of experience, psychologically, do you realize that being in the military is almost perfectly identical to being in prison?
Yeah, but we get guns.
Well, exactly. Who has the guns is flipped.
Right.
But my point being that the type of psychological stresses and traumas and the type of social stresses and, you know, whatever that a person is under, if you compare prison to the military, and now, once again, let me be very clear here. I am not comparing soldiers to criminals. Okay, let me make that abundantly clear. Number two, I am not saying that being in the military is the same as being in prison. What I am saying is that for different reasons, the two groups struggle with similar issues,
but
for different reasons.
Having worked in the military prison, this one is near and dear to my heart,
right?
Because I have been around soldiers who were prisoners.
All right. So let me move to something that's quite a bit more lighthearted here as a sort of a bridge topic to role playing as a military character. There's an exercise that I know we've mentioned on the show that I did back in 1994, 95, which is when the game XCOM came out here in the U.S. And here, I believe it was called Enemy Unknown, whereas I think in Europe, it was called UFO Defense, or maybe that's backwards. In one place, it's called UFO Defense. In the other place, it's called Enemy Unknown. When that came out, I've mentioned that I took a character editor, rebuilt everyone to A, be able to hit a target, and B, to resemble people that I actually knew. This was before I had broad access to the internet or anything like that. So I would sit there and I would narrate mostly to Chad and to a guy named Paul. This is what's going on. Okay, so we just went out on this mission, and here's why so-and-so's doing this, and here's why so-and-so's doing that. And then after the mission, we get back to base, and here's what the attitudes are like, and here's how everyone's interacting and coping. And we got to a mission where Tex ended up killed, and, you know, I dealt with the how are things occurring back at base, you know, having had my own brother killed and whatever. XCOM just got re-released back, I guess it was, what, last month. I started up a game where I started naming people after folks I knew and just screwing around on Facebook, just giving sort of a play-by-play, since I didn't have an audience other than my dog to listen to me. I was just giving a play-by-play of, this is my XCOM game and here's what's going on.
One thing that really amused me about that was my wife missed the initial post on Facebook about what you were doing.
Yeah, she had a War of the Worlds moment.
I came home one day and she looks at me and she goes, I think Dan might have had a nervous breakdown. He's talking about aliens on Facebook.
she had a War of the Worlds tune in halfway through moment. But so I started doing that. I started, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, this is what's going on. Here's what's going on back at base. Here's the play by play. And I really just kind of was doing it for my own entertainment. I thought at most, maybe like some of my friends that knew me back when I did the first one, like Chad, might get a kick out of it. But what I found, surprisingly, was that not only the people that were by name involved, but even people who had nothing to do with the narrative were enjoying the story. And so they start saying, hey, could you start cross posting this elsewhere? And so I started putting it over on the Fear the Boot blog, in addition to having it on my Facebook page. And so if you want to check this out, you can go to feartheboot.com. And on the right hand side of links, there's a link to an entire segment of blog posts called the XCOM Saga. And I'll probably put it in the show notes as well.
And but something about this really caught me off guard. You know, as you're posting all of these, suddenly I see Ryan post something in character and Tex post something in character. And Beth and I both start posting, and the four of us start doing role playing on Facebook comments.
Virtual LARPing.
I've never experienced anything like this. The idea of, I've never done, you know, just text role playing to begin with, but all of us were posting in character. And then more people started doing it, and more. And before you know it, there's this huge in character game going on about Dan's video game.
Well, I said what surprised me even more was the fact that anyone cared. I mean, I thought it was just going to be me kind of pissing in the wind, but it got a cult following of people who were not named characters, just random individuals saying, like, I love this, keep it going. So, all right, here's my point to it, though. Fundamentally, especially once you guys started getting involved, once it moved past my Schrodinger's thought experiment, you know, and became sort of kind of this crowdsourced role playing project. Once it hit that point, what we really had going is a military role playing game.
We're not talking a joking game either. The in character posts, it all really started after Pat was killed in the game.
Yeah, Pat was killed. I won't spoil some of the later things that happened for him that hasn't picked this up. Two other characters end up dead. One person is still struggling with a traumatic brain injury, which has left both psychological and physiological ongoing harm. And it's very serious.
This is the deepest and most serious in-depth role-playing that I've been a part of in months.
Well, because you've talked about your struggles, Wayne. You've talked about your struggles, especially like in a sci-fi setting. But at the same time, once you realize that you were in play, you embraced that character.
Oh, yeah. And it was easy to do because it was, yes, it's experiences I haven't had, but I didn't have to create the character.
But what I'm saying is that you took that, you just presupposed all of that genericism that people like to place, you know, oh, you're a soldier, your head is shaved, da-da-da-da-da-da. And what you did was you got over all of that, you got over your first kiss, and then you did what a human being does. You reacted to it, you put yourself in the situation, and these are role-playing games. You played a role, but you took what you know as a human being, which is what every soldier is. You know, every soldier has a story. Instead of trying to look at it from a soldier standpoint, to me, it seems like you jumped into the role as a human being.
Yeah, and I can also say from having experienced it, and I definitely want Ryan's take on this based on his last post on there, the last one I can remember him posting. It was so serious that, I don't know, it would make me partially uncomfortable for a future military game because of how deep it got into character. You know, in this case, it was so serious. Some of the posts are actually difficult to write because you're talking about your friend's death. It's a lot of very deep emotions that are coming out of it. And it's, I never would have imagined getting even slightly emotional about something I was putting on Facebook. But well, some of it was hard to write. And Ryan?
Consider this. And Cape, you touched upon the point, point I was going to make. Now, I'm going to assume that, Wayne, you've mentioned you've been in the military, but consider that no one's born in the military. No one comes into this world with soldiers stamped on their head unless they're born into the Spartan Empire back in the day.
Or Coney gets on one of the two.
But consider that I had people that raised me. I grew up in a specific culture. I had, you know, some level of cultural indoctrination that went into me. I have a value system. There's going to be a moment where your feet first get into the fire, and you're going to react according to that value system, according to what you can accept and what can't you. And you're going to keep going on, going from beyond that. Consider that your character is a medic, and medics typically are the most prone to PTSD because they see everything the enemy does. They can't shut that experience out because it's their job, it's their lane.
And I was amazed. I was hinting at survivor's guilt without being obvious about it, and you picked it up on it like that. I mean, just the slightest hint, you immediately saw where I was going.
Mm-hmm. And you'll have that with soldiers, especially when they've experienced it themselves. There's no demonization. It's, I see myself in you, and I can accept that.
Wayne, when you were in episode 273, when you were talking about your difficulty in creating a military character because you needed more of the setting, it was almost like you're trying to paint details on a blank canvas instead of painting in broad strokes, where you got the universality of the human experience. And when you're creating the character, to take the basic stereotypes of what you want in the background before you create a character that joins the military, and then you start some of the details you start doing within the group template of what is the specialty you're going to have within the group, and then, you know, how is that all going to fit together within the group context, and then you start building out from there. Like when I say urban poor, regardless of genre or era, you automatically start to assume certain things. And if I put urban poor medieval, it begins to flesh it out more. And I think if you start doing the broad strokes and leave the details for later on within character creation or even within gameplay, you'll end up having a richer character than just trying to worry about the details up front.
You know, that's one of the things I've always struggled with, too, is figuring out what my role in a group is when it comes to a military game. It's a lot easier in a game that has, like, archetypes and things where you can...
Well, so does the military. They're called MOS.
Mm-hmm. But I'm more familiar with the archetypes than I am the MOSs. Well,
yeah, but at the same time, you've never shot a magic missile out of your hand, but you can play a wizard. And I think part of it is that it's the reality of the military experience that scares you.
That's part of it, I think,
and,
too.
And that even like in an infantry fire team, they're very defined roles. That guy with that big machine gun, that M240 Bravo, that's the heavy machine gunner. And he provides support. That guy with that grenade mounted under his weapon, he provides indirect fire. That guy with the radio on his back, I mean, in a way, it's almost easier to define your role because you look at the equipment that you have, and that's one of the things also where the responsibility comes as a GM, because I write an article for Role Players Chronicle called Tales from the Gazebo, where I talk about GMing, and thank you for getting that. And you know, when you talk about like Fear the Boot, you guys are, you know, famous for the group template. Well, as a GM, if I know your playing style, Wayne, I can say, okay, I can make this NPC the squad leader, and then I can say, you know what, Wayne, you normally play, what kind of characters you normally play?
Worthless.
Okay, you play bards?
I have been a bard twice.
Okay, well, you could either be the combo guy, and it seems like a stretch, because then you can also say, oh, the wizard, you know, calls in the fire, yeah. But you could either be the combo guy.
Chaplain.
You could be a chaplain, which could also be your cleric. You could be somebody who's, say, a military intelligence guy, or a human intelligence collector. So, I mean, I'm saying that
force multiplier.
So a psyops guy. If your DM, GM, whatever you want to call it, wants to take that tack, they can kind of assign that role to you, which again, because that creation process is hard for you, but the military in a way gives you the built-in party template.
And that would make it a lot easier in my case. If someone gave me a starting point and I started fleshing it out, I think I could do a lot with a character.
I think one of the struggles that I have observed a lot of people have, the military, well, I'll say at least within the culture that I exist within, so 21st century American culture. Maybe people in other countries don't see this, but this is how it looks to me. The military very much seems to have a culture of other. Now, let me explain that. You go back to movies like Full Metal Jacket, and you see this portrayal of boot camp where it's not just training. It is this inhuman destroyer of men where, I mean, you are not just disciplined. I mean, you are reduced to just subhuman mud and destroyed. And from everyone I've talked to, and I don't know if I've asked you three this specific question, but to every other veteran I've talked to, the question has come out, so was your experience in basic really that much like Full Metal Jacket? And the response has pretty universally been no.
Well, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but if we take the three of us, let's start with our old timer circa 1987. And let's work our way up, because I think what you're going
to
see.
Well, and I'll do it. But hold on 1 second. We'll get right back to that. The second thought is then the military as a recruitment tactic played off of that. Not per se the cruelty that's presented in Full Metal Jacket, but the sense that to be a part of it is to have achieved something almost superhuman.
Thank you, Marine Corps commercials.
Bingo. The few, the proud, the Marine. And here you have a guy with his Marine saber fighting a flaming rock golem. And you get,
also known as an insurgent.
But you
look just like that.
But yeah, several story tall flaming rock golem. But you get the sense, nonetheless, that I can be a human, a regular, everyday, off-the-street human being, and I'm a programmer, or I'm a cook, or I'm the trash guy, or I'm a congressman. But the moment I'm in the military, I am something else. I have changed into this other. Okay, so Wayne, do you think, is that part of your struggle?
One thing that kind of sticks to that is, in my head, and I don't think I've ever mentioned this, because I don't think I ever realized before sitting here, the military is more real to me than, say, a wizard. A wizard casting a lightning bolt isn't as real as a rocket-propelled
grenade or somebody calling in artillery.
And I don't have in my mind, here's how a wizard should behave, or I don't have all of that.
But why does that stigma make it harder? Because for me, which I know is easier to roleplay, not
I have
harder.
Such respect for the military, I'm afraid of not doing it justice.
Gotcha. I want to stop you right there. When one of your concerns, which may be shared by some people listening, is because it is real, out of honor for these people and what they do, you want to get it right.
Yeah.
And so therefore you want to do it justice. We have two military vets and one active service. I want you guys to respond to that. How do you feel about people role playing in the military, even if they don't get it quite right?
As long as you are within the spirit of it, I don't mind. If I see you are doing something that would be not in comportance with the actions that I have from my own past, I'll correct you. Let you know, hey, you shouldn't do this. Do this. I won't do it to belittle you at the table or anything like that. I want you to play the best military personnel you can. And because you don't come from the background that I or any of the other guys have, it's understandable. It's, you know, a little bit of grace and mercy needs to be shown. But if you get so wrapped up and I feel so unworthy, to be honest, we all were unworthy when we went in. When Cap was talking about going back old school, Full Metal Jacket was not too far off the line. There was less of the physicality, but getting your face, calling you maggot, the brutality of the verbal abuse, because they are literally taking you, stripping you completely down to get you to the bare coal that you are, put you under heat and pressure to try and make you a diamond, even if it is, you know, an industrial grade diamond.
Ryan, you want to hit it next?
Well, my philosophy is that it's a game. It will mean exactly to whoever plays the game and what they envision it. If they want to have a game like Halo 4, their Master Chief shooting the Covenant, go ahead, have a great time. If you want to understand more of the military experience, then there's plenty of knowledge available for you to do so, especially with all the veterans coming back. Games have a lot of power when it comes to the Iliad. Back in Greek society, when soldiers came back, they used to tell the Iliad again and again and again until everyone got it. And games have the power to do that when it comes to taking someone who's never been the military and giving them an idea of something they'll never experience, but is quite real that other people have. But it's your game. Have fun, make mistakes, and make the best, most spectacular, the buildings burning down mistakes that you can.
Yeah, I can say that what we've been doing on Facebook has been chilling at times. As it has been the most intense roleplay I've done in a long time. Part of having been part of it makes me nervous of it in the future, but part of it makes me want to do that. I mean, that has been absolutely incredible. It's easier to do, and it's easier to bear all like that because it is Facebook, and it's not face-to-face.
Well, yeah, but ironically, it's for the whole world to see.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that Sergeant Dan really touched on is you talked about training moments. One of the things that I like to do when I run a military game, and I kind of am loath to admit this, but I've run Palladium's Recon a few times, but I actually gave my players a map reading class. I taught them how to read grid coordinates. Mm. And so one of the things that I did is I did it one of two ways. I either just let the player roll a dice to see if they called in the artillery correctly, or if the actual player could get the grid coordinate, and it was just four-digit grid coordinates. Mm-hmm. Then they called in fire correctly. No dice roll needed.
Excellent.
And so what I tried to do is this kind of the same thing that I would do for my soldiers. As a non-commissioned officer, your primary function is to train soldiers. Officers come up with training for soldiers and they manage training. But the backbone of the Army, the non-commissioned officer, the backbone of the military, their job is to train soldiers. So what I would do is if we were in a situation like that where we're in a military campaign, I would try to show you some of those things. If you were the commo guy, I would copy and put out the phonetic alphabet for you to use. I would try to give you that micro experience because, one, you're learning something, but it's a way for me to share that experience without belittling you. And actually showing you that some of the stuff that we do that seems very complicated is so simple a private can do it.
Now, I wanted to say that while those were three somewhat differing responses, there's one thing I did not hear from any of these three guys, which is, Wayne, it offends me that you would want to play make-believe with my with what that part of my life. All three of them seemed encouraged, engaged, maybe even a little bit honored that you were interested in that part of their life, that you're interested in that entire subculture, you know. And obviously, look, the military is going to be as diverse as there are people in it. And I totally accept that. So I'm not saying that these three guys can speak on behalf of an organization that has, what is it, 1.5 million active duty members at any given moment. Plus, who knows, you know, I don't have a count of reservists and veterans and whatever. But the point being, though, from three, at least these three people, what you're hearing unanimously is no level of offense that...
So I want to hit on a terminology thing here as well, Dan. Obviously, I know what reservists are, because I've actually known quite a few reservists. But you mentioned commission versus non-commission. That's something I've always wondered about. What does that exactly mean? I knew what enlisted versus unenlisted meant, you know, in previous times. What is commission versus non-commission?
Commissioned officers generally have college educations within the United States military structure. A non-commissioned officer, an NCO, is a person within the Marine Corps context, is E4 and above. And staff non-commissioned officers are E6 and above. And generally, the enlisted rankings, they're the guys with the experience. Sergeants and corporals, they're the first echelon. It is their responsibility to get the initial job done. They're at the lowest level of making sure the mission is accomplished. Commissioned officers have more of that responsibility, although there is a joke within the military that says, what's the difference between a second lieutenant and a private first class? And the private first class has been promoted. And even within the enlisted ranks and the commissioned officer ranks, there is that hierarchy. And generally, like the lieutenants, behooves of the lieutenants to listen to their E5s, E6, E7s, because they've been around. They know how the game is played, so to speak. And if you get somebody that does not listen to their senior enlisted, they have a short life expectancy in combat. Let alone even in civilian, in peacetime, they aren't going to get promoted as quick because they're going to build up resentment and they're not going to have the respect of their subordinate.
This might be a really, really bad analogy. And if it is, definitely tell me. Is it analogous to, like, in the business world, a white collar versus a blue collar worker?
Sure.
Actually, the allegory that came to my mind is the movie Aliens. Certainly, I think the people within there were behaving in a manner which the lack of discipline and respect would probably not fly in most military units. But more the part I'm going after is the distinction between the sergeant and the lieutenant, where the sergeant, he had much tighter relationships with the troops. He had a lot more combat experience. The lieutenant was a little bit more standoffish, had less combat experience. And I, once again, I realize not every...
Well, one of the things about that that's interesting is also it's very differentiated between the services based on their missions. Jokingly, I have to get this one in here. The abbreviation for lieutenant is LT. And we used to always say you can't spell lost without LT. but you take, for instance, the Navy. Okay, the Navy, they are on these very small, cramped ships.
Right.
And yet, officers dine separately from enlisted men. And it's part of the naval tradition, but there is a huge separation. Officers are berthed in different areas of a ship. And there's actually areas on the ship that are called officer country. And that if you're an enlisted guy, a petty officer or a seaman, I love saying seaman, and you get called into officer country, either you did really well or you really screwed up. You take other entities like the Air Force. The Air Force is the one service.
Civilians in uniform.
It is a corporate entity, but you guys have to admit, the Air Force is the one service that sends its highest paid personnel into combat, mm-hmm. which is its fighter pilots.
Yeah, which are
all commissioned officers.
Yeah.
But the relationship between that officer and their flight crew is a very different situation than, say, a platoon leader or a company commander in the Army or in the Marine Corps, because of the nature of that guy is mounting those missiles. Are those bombs or those that have to go in? So there's a different dynamic there. And then when you take the Army, even within the different jobs fields in the Army, because an infantry officer who's leading from the front properly, Army or Marine Corps, you know, it's blood, sweat, and tears. And if it's Private Joe Snuffy, it's Private Joe Snuffy next to him. You know, military police corps. Out in the field, the officers were in charge, and the senior NCOs just took care of beds, beans, and bullets. But back in the rear, it was completely changed, and that was by nature of the mission. So even within the different services, the officer ranks are very different. Like, for instance, in the Coast Guard, you have a boarding officer that is generally a lower-ranking ensign, and that person goes on those interdiction boats and is responsible when those Coast Guard personnel step on that boat that they're searching. That interdiction officer is responsible for the entire interdiction. And so that's a very intimate setting. You got four Coast Guard guys on a, you know, on a 20-foot boat checking for oars. Just kidding, Coasties. you know, puddle pirates. No. But I worked with the Coast Guard as a Navy Sea Cadet out in the San Francisco Bay. And prior to Iraq or Afghanistan, the Coast Guard was seeing more action than all of our services combined.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, don't they also have the strictest entry requirements of any of the branches?
They do, because there's like 10 of them. I mean, I was on the largest Coast Guard station in the United States.
Right.
At Coast Guard Station Yerba Buena over by the San Francisco Bay Bridge. And there were like 150 people there. And they were talking about how huge it was. And I was like, my first company in the Army had twice that many people. But there is a different interaction just even between the services.
Also, getting back to the difference between being in garrison and being out in the field, either in combat or on a field training exercise, I knew Lance Corporals that were in charge of entire field depots that would have had a major in charge of it if it was back here in the States. And a lot of that just depends, one, on the quality of the person you're dealing with and the situation you find yourself in. Sometimes all you got is this one guy who knows that job really well, and it doesn't matter what his rank is. And if you want something from him, regardless of your rank, you better be nice to him.
Never piss off cooks, never piss off medics, and always avoid MPs.
Never piss off S1 either. They got your pay.
Yeah, that's personnel, for those of you who don't know.
That's a very interesting idea that I never really thought about. I always had the assumption of if you outrank someone, you can go and give them a direct command and they will, you know, the idea that someone could be in charge of something.
Wayne, how well does that play out in the corporate world?
It tends to happen, though.
I mean, well, yeah, in my experience in the corporate world, vice president comes out and says, you need to do this. Okay, granted, because the vice president said so, it will tend to get done. That does not mean there won't be passive aggression, heel dragging, maybe even sometimes outright insubordination. Now, I'm not saying that that's, especially with the insubordination, that may not be the norm. But the point being that, look, there is one consistency across all of this. People are people are people are people are people. And while the military may have layers of discipline and, depending on the branch, an impenetrable bureaucracy and all this other stuff, it is still constructed of people functioning and the basic social units that people always organize themselves into.
I guess the difference is I always imagine the chain of command as being far more ingrained and more strict with the military than anywhere else.
Well, the thing is, if you jump chain, it can be to your detriment. You have a chain of command. You have the private, then you have his platoon sergeant, then you have the company gunny and the first sergeant, and then the company commander. And if the private goes straight to the company commander, bypassing that chain of command, he may get the initial outcome he's looking for, but he is utterly pissed off everybody between him and the company commander.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things is there's also a chain of concern. You
right.
have a chain of command because you'll notice that there was no mention of a team leader or a squad leader. And so what happens is you actually have these two parallel chains because you have your chain of command, but then your chain of concern is people who you deal with. Like if I'm a private, I deal with my team leader, and my team leader should take any of those issues through the chain of command. But at times you can jump your chain of concern and your chain of command, and then it's not such a happy panda.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.